Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're joined by Catherine Mangu Ward, Editor-in-Chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks for talking to us.
Hi there, Nick.
And we're also joined by Brian Dougherty, Senior Editor of Reason out on the West Coast, and he's also the author of a bunch of books, including Radicals for Capitalism, This is Burning Man. And Brian, what is your book about the Ron Paul Revolution? What's the subtitle of that?
It's Ron Paul's Revolution, The Man and the Movement He Inspired.
All right. So thank you for joining us. Yeah. So let's start by talking about United Airlines. It was a big week for them and for a lot of discussions about government policy, corporate policy, United. Brian, you wrote a couple of pieces about the United brouhaha. What do you think is the thing that needs to be taken away from a situation where a flight was overbooked and a person who refused to take the compensation to get off the plane was dragged kicking and screaming, really, and was actually suffered some serious medical problems? What's the big takeaway as far as you're concerned? What does this tell us about a contemporary America?
I want to start with what it does not tell us, because too many people, including America's least favorite governor, Chris Christie, jumped to the conclusion that the problem is the very practice of overbooking, which I think most of us understand how that works now, because we've probably been, on the bad end of it. But airlines have a practice of selling more seats on an airplane than there actually are physically seats. And your sort of very first reaction to this might be, well, isn't that fraud? You know, it's like they're promising to deliver a service that they're not prepared to deliver. The thing that makes it work is an innovation introduced by this great libertarian world economist named Julian Simon. Back in the bad regulated days of airlines, when this situation arose, airlines would solve it kind of the way they solved the problem with Dr. Dow last week. They would just decide, hey, we're kicking certain people off. And my understanding of the system they would use, and this is really gross, is that they would try to figure out who are the people least likely to raise a fuss about it. And they would actually aim the practice at old people and the military, because they thought they were more inclined to take order. So that's bad. If they solve the problem by kicking people off, that's bad. We saw how bad it is with Dr. Dow. The good way to solve it, not surprising that a libertarian would say this, is the free market way, which is let's offer a price to get people to voluntarily choose to give up the seat. And that's the system that Julian Simon suggested they introduce, and they did. And it generally works really well. But the only way it works really well is if they keep raising the price until they get the volunteer. This is the mistake United made. By all the reporting, they started with a $400 offer, didn't get enough volunteers, went up to an $800 offer, didn't get enough volunteers, and then just decided to start busting heads. That was not the way to do it.
Yeah, is there any background on why they didn't go up higher? Because my understanding is that the general rule is you can offer up to, and it's regulated by the government, but even though airline ticket prices have been deregulated, it's up to four times the average fare price, but it can't exceed something like $1,345, something like that.
It actually can. A lot of people have misunderstood this. Libertarians, for understandable reasons, are very quick when they see a company in the private sector acting in a way that seems irrational or counterproductive. They like to, and a lot of times it is true, that maybe there's a government regulation that's shaping their incentives or shaping their actions. What that regulation says on the surface, and I've not had anyone who actually works in the industry tell me that it's different in practice, is it says it establishes a legal responsibility on the airline's part to make whole someone that they're kicking off. And I do not know the legislative history, but in nearly all cases, when sort of minimums or maximums are set, it's because the regulated industry said, hey, let's cap our legal responsibility at this. But that does not say that it is illegal for them to offer more. It merely says, if you offer this much, then you have satisfied your legal obligation. And if none of the passengers want to take that, then, legally, they can go pound sand. But the law does not say you are breaking the law to offer more. So it's conceivable, I guess, that no one on that flight paid more than $200 for a ticket. Mm-hmm. That would seem surprising to me. I do not have the data on that. If everyone did pay under $200, then they met their legal obligation at $800. But regardless of their legal obligation, obviously the smart thing to do, both for the sake of human decency, for the sake of the United stock price, for the sake of David Dow's head, was to keep raising the price. There is no way on earth you can convince me that that whole situation wouldn't have been resolved both quicker and cheaper for United by just saying, okay, no takers at 800. How about 1,000? No takers, how 100? It was all quicker, faster, easier.
So, Brian, actually, Catherine, let me turn to you. Overbooking, which one of the stories that came out of this debacle was the idea that, well, this is what you get with unregulated airline ticket prices. You get arbitrary rule by thugs who come and drag and beat, medical doctors, I guess. We don't know exactly what kind of doctor Dr. Dow was, but overbooking goes back to the 50s, and it was, as Brian was suggesting, it was kind of an elegant solution to no-shows because it matters. You want to fly, as few planes filled with as many people as possible. Have you ever, have you ever taken compensation when offered to delay your travel?
No, but that's because I'm an entitled millennial yuppie who just wants exactly the service that I paid for at exactly the time I paid for it. I think actually the trouble with the United defense of overbooking is that it sounds mealy-mouthed and corporate when it is actually a deep and exciting truth about markets. When they say, listen, the reason we do overbooking is because it actually enables us to provide more service to more people than we would otherwise be able to do. We would have to fly planes with empty seats, and there would be people who wished they were on those seats if we couldn't overbook. And it sounds like we are providing you the best possible service at the best rate. It sounds like a totally kind of lame automated response when, in fact, it's exactly what they're doing. That's why they overbook. They want to maximize their profits, but they also want to get people where they want to go. And I think it's odd that the response to this has been to pinpoint overbooking, except for that in this case, we also brought to bear the kind of the endowment effect, right? Because the guy was already in his seat. We had a kind of possession 9/10 of the law situation going on as well,
and
which
I
you
guess,
typically don't have when you're sitting in the airport lobby and someone's saying, how about $800?
There was also the question of that they needed 4 seats, apparently, to fly United employees. I think the flight was going to Louisville, and they needed those people to be ready to start in the morning. Brian, do you, I guess Catherine raises a point that it's kind of floating in the backdrop of a lot of things about corporate entities where, corporations are oftentimes the worst advocates for capitalism and free markets and for the, kind of the benefits of a fully functioning market. Where does that come from, and is it possible to address this? I know people like Rose Wilder Lane and Ayn Rand, among others, constantly were decrying, and more recently somebody like Luigi Zingales at University of Chicago denounced capitalists for being the worst defenders of what they do, and to constantly be reminding people that profits and treating people well are actually simpatico, that they're not at odds with each other. Is there a way to address that in any kind of meaningful way?
I think Catherine hit a corporation often lacks people to actually be able to give a convincing, full-blooded defense of that point you just made. That it's not an opposition for a corporation to try to do the best for itself and to try to treat the customers the best. Like, generally, those two dovetail. In the case of airline overbooking, if you have the Julian Simon mechanism of offering customers the right price, in that case, they dovetail perfectly. They do not dovetail perfectly when they solve the problem, by beating someone up and dragging them off the plane. And on the regulated issue, of course, as I said earlier, it was when the industry was highly regulated that every overbooked seat was dealt with by the airline arbitrarily deciding who was going to get beaten off. So it's completely contra the facts to say that, deregulation led to this situation. In fact, this was like the regulated situation. Corporations, I just want to wrap up. Corporations are definitely afraid to be full-throated defenders of how their interests and the customer's interests go together, because I think they're afraid to be full-throated defenders of their own interests. So they end up, you know, and people don't trust them to begin with. So that also makes them not the best, you know, advocates.
Well, what do you think, you know, in different contexts? I mean, Volkswagen is going through, Catherine, Volkswagen is going through a major kind of, you know, forgiveness tour. For lying, apparently, for cheating on, you know, the way that they doctored certain types of readouts on cars, on certain types of diesels that were supposed to be clean burning. There's also the example of Domino's pizza, which has, for the past couple of years, they've been like, hey, you know what, we admit it, our pizza really sucked. And, you know, we're changing the way our shops look, we're changing our product. Does that work to instill confidence in markets or in individual companies, do you think?
I think that the show of contrition is actually more effective than the systematic argument for markets, which is just speaks to the way that human psychology works. I mean, one thing that I think is potentially shifting right now is that people are less sympathetic to arguments that work on net. That is, when airlines say, yes, this one person is harmed, but in addition to the fact that overbooking allows people to fly when they couldn't otherwise fly, also us trying to get this crew so that another flight could fly would be a huge boon to all the people on that flight. But it's true. A person, at least one person, will be harmed. In this case, of course, they were he was physically harmed. Yeah. But, you know, even if it hadn't ended badly, of course, he still would have been inconvenienced if he had just even taken the money and gotten off the flight. But I think the susceptibility to arguments on net might be decreasing, that people want somehow to hear or to be told no one will be harmed. Everyone will be better off. The only solutions, policy solutions or corporate policy solutions that are acceptable are ones in which we have a kind of, you know, the least well off are pulled up while everyone else remains static or is their quality of life is also increased. And that's a deep philosophical divide about how we should structure our society and what justice looks like.
Well, it's also kind of a false argument, isn't it? Because nobody, you know, you can say, well, we're never going to inconvenience anybody or nobody is ever going to be a loser in any kind of exchange. But in fact, that happens. And, you know, when I think that you're right, Catherine, that on net, you know, these on net arguments are losing the power that they once had, because, you know, when we think about trade and immigration, which are two topics that the Trump administration often sounds like Democrats used to about saying, well, there are, you know, we're focusing on the losers. And, you know, instead of saying on net immigration, both legal and illegal, is a benefit to the economy, on net trade is a benefit to the economy, we're increasingly looking at the people who are displaced or discomfited by that, and we have to address that somehow. Is that a, you know, that's a real tough nut for libertarian discourse to crack, isn't it? Because, you know, I mean, you know, if economics is anything, it's a study of trade-offs and scarcity of people wanting, you know, effectively an unlimited amount of goods with a limited amount of means to supply them or to pay for them. You know, what would you, Brian, suggest is, you know, is a step forward to kind of address these issues and you know, change the way people think about this stuff?
I want to start by saying I actually do believe that the airline overbooking situation is a pure win-win if the Simon mechanism works. But trade is definitely not. And that's why I have always been of the belief that merely economic efficiency arguments are not sufficient to sell the full libertarian package, because what you have to get into with the whole issue of trade and who wins and who loses is who has a right, who has the right of possession over something. And your sort of Trumpian mentality on its surface seems to be, if you have a job, if you were lucky enough to have a well-paying job in the production of great industrial culture, this sort of narrow moment of human history, that that's yours. But what a libertarian, or at least what I would say, is no, that job is a relationship between you and another entity. Neither of you have a right to it except what you've contractually agreed to. You can quit if you want to quit. They can fire you if they want to fire you, or if they have to fire you. So yeah, the trade argument has to depend on who has rights of possession. It can't just be, oh, who's going to be hurt? Because sometimes someone else's choices might hurt you. But that doesn't mean you have a right to make them stop the choice in all circumstances.
How does that
play
out?
I hope that
out?
Doesn't sound too airy-fairy. But.
No. I mean, it sounds denuded of, the warmth of human compassion on a certain level, even as I find it totally convincing. No, and, this is, as if people who have been displaced in kind of old industrial factories that haven't that shut down 30 or 40 years ago in Buffalo or northern Wisconsin, as if, some illegal Mexican who's working in the back of a kitchen in Los Angeles, these two things are not connected. And merely locking up Mexicans or keeping them out of the country isn't going to do anything to help the Wisconsin person. And I guess what I'm saying to you, Brian, is how does that kind of scheme that you just discussed or that logic, how does that play out with immigration? Is it the same type of thing?
There are certain facts that you should be able to rely on in that argument. The one you just alluded to, that if your complaint is, the great high-paying, well-pensioned industrial jobs are disappearing, let's build a wall and keep out the Mexicans. We understand factually that those two are barely connected, that the great driver of the loss of well-paying, well-pensioned industrial jobs is not Mexicans coming over the border. It's industrialization. It's mechanization. It's the things that definitely make everyone on Earth richer. International trade, absolutely no question, has raised certainly Catherine talked earlier about policies that benefit the least well off. There is no question that on an international scale, that international trade mechanization helps the least well off tremendously. We've seen absolute poverty nearly cut in half, since World War II, or probably sooner. But if you are in the game of convincing people of this, you can try to sell that to people. And it's true and it's undeniable, but they're still going to be upset that the well-pensioned, well-paying industrial jobs are gone. And it is difficult. There is a certain point where you probably do have to say something, like you said, that sounds lacking in, the milk of human kindness, which is, I think, why so many people, even a lot of free market people, have been led lately to conclude, let's just do a universal basic income. Let's just try to make sure interfering, and I'm not one of them, but I'm definitely seeing it more and more. Let's, within a largely free market structure, let's not have the trade barriers, let's not have the immigration barriers, but let's take care of the people who lose in that scheme by tossing them a bone. And I understand why people come to that conclusion. I'm enough of a hardcore, heartless libertarian purist that I'm not really there yet, but I get it.
It would be interesting to do a tally. In each of us, Brian and I are pretty close in age. Catherine, you're a few years younger, but just to think about all of the jobs that have disappeared. For instance, I had a friend whose parents owned a photograph company, one of the one-hour photo booths, and they ran a photo mat booth in a parking lot, too, and that's just gone, and there are whole industries like that within recent memory that have disappeared that nobody has any affection for. Nobody cries about the fact now that increasingly washing machines also do dry cleaning or a version of that, and that dry cleaning is, it's a tough business. It's a tough racket now because fewer and fewer clothes need that. But nobody cares about dry cleaners. Nobody cares about photo booth developers. There's probably a long list of jobs, and maybe giving people a sense of the churn that happens every day, or every year might be a way of kind of pulling people back to the recognition that, one person's gain does not come at another person's loss necessarily, and that trying to attack people for showing up here is not going to help people who have been displaced by technology or a shift in consumer demands. Catherine, you flagged a story about Arkansas, which I believe was going to do something like execute 11 people in 8 days or 8 people in 11 days. And then they had to hold up because of problems getting the lethal injection drugs they use. What is going on there?
Right. So this is a great sort of convergence of all of the horror stories about the death penalty as it is currently practiced in the United States happening all at once. It's Arkansas. There were meant to be 4 double executions, so 8 executions over an 11-day period. And that weird, super dense execution schedule was occasioned by the fact that the drugs that are meant to be used for these executions were about to expire, right? So this is like, you look at the milk in your fridge and you're like, oh, I guess I'm having cereal for dinner tonight because I gotta use this up, which is that's insane. That is a very, very bad way to make life and death decisions. And totally appropriately, a judge in the Arkansas Supreme Court said, you know what, let's take a minute and think about this. But the provision of these drugs, the reason that they are worried about the expiration of these drugs is because the provision system for these drugs is so screwed up right now. And many, many companies are refusing to provide these drugs. They say, listen, we don't want to be associated with this practice, which we disapprove of for moral reasons, or which our other customers disapprove of for moral reasons. I think this is in some ways a really cool story of morality coming from the profit motive. I mean, this is right. People who are saying we don't want to get boycotted because we provide execution drugs. Unfortunately, the result is that states that do executions are frequently relying on less and less reputable pharmacies to provide less and less reliable drugs, which in turn produce cruel and unusual outcomes.
It would be ironic, wouldn't it, if we have to start going to clinics in Tijuana to get execution drugs and driving them back?
There's this place which has now been shut down, which was called, I'm not even kidding you, the Apothecary Shop with two P's and an E. And it was providing drugs not only for executions in its own state, I believe Louisiana, but also surrounding states illegally in some cases, because they were the only formulary who were sort of technically met the legal requirements and were willing to provide the drugs.
Well, I'm glad that they use Chape because,
it gives it a nice old-timey
like
touch.
Harry
which,
Potter kind of, it's in Dumbledore.
See, but I think it's more ye olde, right?
Yeah,
and that's an appropriate vibe, frankly, for, I think, the notion that executions are the appropriate way to deal with criminals feels increasingly archaic.
Brian, you've done a lot of drugs. What do you think about execution drugs? Are you for them or against them? And are you for or against the death penalty and why?
Recreational use of execution drugs is what I want to know about.
You can use them responsibly,
I'm sure.
Of course. I've never really written about it. By standards of, anarcho-libertarian justice, I am not completely against the idea that the proper payment for taking a life could be a life. But in the actual practice, this feels silly even talking about this because everyone knows all this and everyone knows what they think. But like, we do have enough examples of the state getting it wrong that it's not a power I'm comfortable giving the state. And so it kind of amuses me to see the whole issue wrapped up in these weird bureaucratic questions of like, what is it legal for us to use to kill this guy? On one level, you want to go, oh, why don't you just chop his head off with a guillotine, if you're deciding to kill him. But I do think it's appropriate that the state surround its own power to kill with a lot of rules, even a lot of niggling rules. And it's great that they are required to live up to those rules. So if we, if we have a standard that says, oh, using this expired drug is cruel and unusual, that's great. But I do not think that conceptually it's wrong to say that the proper punishment for murder is death.
Wow.
But
if it's a life, a life for a life, if the life that is extinguished is, better than the person who killed him, should you kill two people? I'm just trying. Sense of justice.
There's no way to quantify that.
It's also worth noting here that the drug in question is a sedative. The drug that they are worried about the expiration date on is part of a multi-drug protocol. And what this does is essentially knock the guy out before they kill him. We could give him an Ambien, right? Brian is right, of course, to say the more that we hem this in, like if there's ever a moment to be pedantic about bureaucratic stipulations, it is at moments of life and death. But this is a widely available drug. This is it is a drug for which there are many, many substitutes. So it's particularly interesting that we would be that this particular stay of execution would rest on something that could easily be substituted in any other circumstance.
And you can see too, and this is for those of us of a certain age will remember Gary Gilmore, who was executed by firing squad in I think in 1978 in Utah was the first person put to death after many years when the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional, the death penalty. And he birthed probably one of the single best SNL sketches, where it's a Christmas carol about Let's Kill Gary Gilmore for Christmas, as well as the advert song Gary Gilmore's Eyes, which is about because Gilmore donated his body to science. And it's a great song about the guy who wakes up with Gary Gilmore's eyes. But beyond that, aren't we kind of over the death penalty? I lived in Texas when they actually executed over 40 people in a single year. There had been a bunch of court holdups, and then the floodgates opened again, and it was creepy as hell. Basically, it was at least almost one person a week. They had a couple of weeks where there were two or three people being executed. But it seems to me, from a libertarian perspective, Brian, and I don't know how you feel about this, but for me, the goal of the state is to protect citizens with the least amount of violence, by using the least amount of violence. And it seems to me that mitigates or argues against the death penalty, because life in prison does that. It also turns out to be cheaper. We did a documentary at Reason TV a few years ago about how expensive it is to execute somebody in California. And it's many multiples of times the cost of just keeping them locked up, which is no vacation for anybody, either the victim's families or the person themselves. But I mean, is the death penalty, I guess I'll end on this, Catherine and Brian, like, is the death penalty going to make it another 10 years? Or is it just, whether it's because of bureaucratic, weirdness like we're witnessing here in Arkansas, or the general tenor of the times against it? I mean, is the death penalty on death's door? Catherine?
You should be fired for asking the question in that way.
Yeah,
that
was like the worst. It wasn't planned. It was
headline
writing
skills I've ever seen. Yes. Yeah. I think this is a sort of thing that will, that forces other than actual abolition will continue to decrease its use, even if it doesn't disappear entirely. I would be frankly shocked if we as a nation fully abolished the death penalty anytime soon. But I think stuff like, drug companies saying, we're not providing these drugs, go find them elsewhere, you statist pigs, it's a huge win. And it means that the sort of, there are more moral outcomes in the world. I mean, these executions are not being stayed because people are having second thoughts about the death penalty. It's because the optics are bad, because there are so many of them back to back for a stupid reason.
Right.
But I'm not seeing, even in this federal judge, in his decision to stay these executions, he didn't say, because we as a nation no longer think it's right to execute prisoners. He said, like, hold on, this is a bad reason to do this in this way right now.
Do you think if it's bad for drug companies, they don't want to have their drug in the cocktail that's used to kill people? And there have been a number of botched executions, within recent memory, where the drugs didn't work as advertised. But will then bullet companies, bullet manufacturers say, hey, if we go to a firing squad, we don't want our bullets or our guns involved. We don't, rope makers, guillotine makers, I'm sure there's still some of them, electric chairs. I mean, would it be the same thing over and over again until, finally, we go to like a Shirley Jackson lottery scenario where it's just stones?
I think I actually walked by a artisanal guillotinery in Brooklyn the last time I was there. So, you can always get those bespoke. But
all right. Brian, do you think the death penalty will vanish from land of the free?
I'm terrible at predicting social trends, but I will say that in Trump's America, it does not feel like, classic 70s bleeding heart liberalism is on the rise. So I guess I don't see it going away entirely anytime soon.
Well, and that we just spoke about death, and so now let's talk about taxes. Today is the day before taxes are due to localities, states, and the federal government. Catherine, have you filed your taxes?
I filed for an extension because my husband works in venture capital, and startups are really freaking terrible at getting their paperwork in line for their investors. So we are waiting for a K-1 from the asteroid mining company that we are invested in, Planetary Resources. If you're out there listening to me, get it together, guys.
You may have just committed insider trading. I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. No, it's fine. Obviously, there is not. I don't think that what they're doing is illegal. Merely annoying to me and my accountant. But I did. I did already pay my estimated taxes.
Brian, have you paid your taxes yet?
No, merely because of a general sloth and inability to do anything. But I do intend to. I have all the facts together. Right. I need to print out the forms and write them down. I feel like if I put in about 3 hours tonight, I will get it done. I have not chosen to file the old tax honesty trick of the zero taxable income return, though pretty much daily I get emails because I've written about that world of people who believe there is not actually a legal obligation to pay.
Yeah, it says so it's voluntary right on it. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. You know, yeah. And, honestly, it makes more sense to me every time I hear about it, but just merely because it would be quick and easy. But, yeah, I'm going to, like many Americans, I'm going to get to it at the last possible evening I could get to it.
I'm right there with you. I have everything done. I use TurboTax, which I'm generally happy with, but it's mostly out of just because I used it the last year and the year before that. But I have everything, and I've got to go back and change a couple of numbers with updated information. But I don't know why. Well, I guess here's a question for you guys, and Catherine, especially given your husband's line of work, I suspect then that you have an accountant, you probably are fairly aggressive in taking deductions. For me, it's less even than the actual amount of taxes that I pay, which are, you know, I mean, it's substantial when you start making money. But I always feel bad about taking the deductions that are legally available to me, not because I don't think I'm worthy, but because I'm always afraid I'm going to fuck it up somehow and then get in trouble. Does that affect you at all?
So I have been audited back when I was 24 years old and earning a sum total of $12. I screwed up and didn't file one of my 1099s appropriately. And there truly is nothing more heart-stopping than opening up a letter from the IRS that says, you are being audited. You know, luckily, because I was only earning $12, even if you screw up your taxes, there's still only so much you can owe. They were like, oh, you owe us, you know, another 50 cents. And I was like, great, here you go. Thanks. Sorry. But yeah, I mean, I think that everyone experiences this, even, you know, no matter what level you're filing your taxes at, this moment where you think, I'm doing this wrong. I'm a smart person. I am a competent and educated human being. I have excellent reading comprehension according to every standardized test I have ever taken, and I do not know what the fuck I am doing right now. And that experience, at least for me, happens exclusively when I am dealing directly with the state or with industries that are deeply enmeshed with the state. And maybe that's just libertarian confirmation bias, but at tax time, I feel like I've got a lot of company there.
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking. There's no question about it. Brian, are you an aggressive exemption taker?
Yeah, when it comes to my freelance writing income, which gets smaller and smaller year by year, yes. When it comes to your standard exemption, every year of my life I've taken the standard. This is actually going to be the first year, because I'm a homeowner now, that it actually is going to pay for me to itemize deductions with the whole completely illegitimate mortgage interest thing that benefits fat cats like me at the expense of the little guy. But otherwise, yeah, I try to be fair both to myself and to old Uncle Sam. And fortunately, I have not ever yet been audited, but, you know, there's always a first time.
You know, a couple of years ago, the Institute for Justice was working on a great case, which they were, I recall, pretty much victorious in, where they were sticking up for small-time tax preparers, that essentially the IRS had tried to sneak in some regulations that strongly favored H&R Block and sort of big guys at the expense of, you know, people who work out of their homes or who just help their friends. That, of course, meant that people in poor neighborhoods who had sort of gray economy tax assistance were more likely to wind up overpaying or misfiling their taxes. That is the Lord's work right there. Sticking up for just like that guy down the street who's pretty good at numbers and helps you out with your taxes. Yeah. And, you know, that guy by rights shouldn't have to exist at all. But if he must, then I certainly want him to be able to compete with H&R Block. Nick, were we still doing the financial issue of Reason during your editorship, or
no,
was that long
yeah,
dead? Because I'm thinking we need to bring that back, because my understanding is we just taught people essentially like the best location to bury their gold coins in the backyard in a coffee can. But
and I think that was partly when owning gold was illegal, so it had the added allure that,
exciting.
But yeah, I mean, Reason used to do financial issues, and it would be typically, if I'm remembering correctly, it would be mostly catastrophic or apocalyptic warnings about how the economy was absolutely on the verge of collapse or was collapsing, and we didn't even recognize it in the 70s and very early 80s. And then that kind of faded. I'm not sure why. I think, it's interesting with, to talk about tax policy. Donald Trump has talked a lot about, like, hey, just wait until you see my tax reform plan. We have Paul Ryan pushing in the same direction on something called the border adjustment tax or border adjustable tax, which, among other things, throws simplification out the window, which used to be a byword for all forms of tax reform, that it would be easy to follow and understand. Do either of you, and Brian, why don't we start with you, do you have any, do you think there's a pressing need for tax reform? And if so, what kind, and if, you know, and how likely is any of that really going to happen? It's really been since the late 80s, since we've had a true tax overhaul.
Yeah, I think it's completely unlikely that anything major happened in those regards. I usually like to speak from the purest libertarian perspective, which makes a lot of these questions kind of uninteresting. But if we do want to live in a world where there is an income tax, I have not seen any reason not to believe that a flat, simplified one that ends all the problems Catherine was talking about smart, competent professionals who find the whole process confusing and incomprehensible. The old, I think Steve Forbes used to say, like, the form that's 10 lines. Frankly, I don't really understand, especially given that the government clearly is supposed to know already every relevant fact about our income, why they don't just send us a bill, honestly, and have us pay it rather than us have to fill out all these forms. But the simpler the better.
The problem with Steve Forbes' plan is that it relies on postcards, and there's an entire generation plus of Americans who have no fucking idea what a postcard is.
Exactly. Yeah.
In another couple of years, he's going to be
one screen.
Yeah, you'll be able to fax it in. And then Steve, come on.
God, the latest and greatest. I love the you should be able to do your taxes on the postcard thing. And Brian's point, of course, that it feels like this elaborate game of gotcha, right? It's like your girlfriend saying, like, so where were you last night? And you're like, oh shit, what does she know? We already know how much money you earned, but now you tell us how much money you earned.
That was supposed to be off limits today.
Thanks
for bringing it up.
I want to
be able to. I want to be able to file my taxes on my Apple Watch. If Steve Forbes goes with that, it'll go through both. Or what do we have? Three or four houses of Congress.
Yeah, we'll definitely Apple Watch taxes are. I think that's a real campaign winner. But I think this idea that that simplified taxes are sort of a silly thing that people raise and then forget is both true and incredibly frustrating, because taxes are so distortionary. And this is a place where liberals and conservatives agree. We should use the tax code to change people's behavior. And screw that. We should not use the tax code to change people's behavior. It should be
to raise the revenue necessary to provide the services, the goods and services that we agree the government should provide. And, tax expenditures, like Brian mentioned, the mortgage interest deduction, healthcare deductions from employers. One of the biggest is actually that the federal government allows you to deduct your state and local taxes, which gives, among other things, it allows states and localities to have higher taxes than they would otherwise, because you're not paying full freight on them. I find really frustrating the idea that we're talking about tax reform, and there's so many people in the broad kind of libertarian conservative world who only care about marginal tax rates and the corporate tax rate. Those are important, but that simplification, as well as that core principle, that revenue taxes are for revenue to run the government to do what we think it should be doing, because part of the problem is we borrow so much money, it's, we're spending like about, we're raising about 65, 75, 80 cents for every dollar of government spending. So we're not even paying full freight. If we knew how much government actually costs us, we would probably insist on less government, if the basic laws of supply and demand mean anything. Catherine, can you end this conversation, this Reason talk show featuring yourself and Brian Doherty, on an upbeat note? We've talked about doctors being punched and dragged off of planes, prisoners being, getting stays of execution, and tax policy. Is there anything else that we should be talking about today?
I don't know, Nick. You really got my tax rage juices flowing. Yeah, tamped it all down, and now I'm full of rage. Here's my upbeat note for you. The next issue of Reason Magazine, which will be out to digital subscribers on Friday, and will be in the mailboxes of print subscribers shortly thereafter, has a great piece by Reason's Mike Riggs, who is just recently back on staff after a little bit of a walkabout. And he is touting the glories of voluntary use of testosterone, both by older people, older men, to make themselves feel stronger, better, younger, and also by bodybuilders and amateur athletes to improve their performance. And it's this very inspirational story of how people have taken the decision-making about the use of this very powerful drug, this hormone, almost entirely outside of the medical establishment. It's just people talking amongst themselves on the internet, figuring out best practices, and it is super cool. It is also illustrated with pictures from vintage muscle mags. I don't know what more you could want
Strength and health, muscle and fitness, that type of stuff. It really is a spectacular story, as well as the images are pretty goddamn incredible. Brian, how much testosterone do you take these days?
I'm a very low T fellow.
So you're like a cuck. That's what you're reading, like a cuck servant.
I'm reading Riggs' work.
Yeah.
So everything I know about the topic, I actually learned from Mike's very fascinating feature. So I have no meaningful comment.
All right. But you will get your taxes done.
Yes. Yeah. Even if I have to stay up very late.
Even if you have to take, an entire tube of testosterone. You know,
I'm pretty sure that's not the unit.
Sprinkle it.
I
don't know. I get the ones. It's the testosterone the astronauts used, and it came in a tube and powder form.
Yeah.
He came back more ripped from the moon than he went up, which is pretty amazing. And you know, and given that, of course, he never left the, he never left the Burbank filming lot.
Soundstage.
That it was all
right,
done. Yeah.
Course.
So. We will leave it there. This has been the Reason Podcast, our talk show for April 17th. Catherine Mangu Ward, Editor-in-Chief of Reason Magazine, thanks so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
And Brian Doherty, Senior Editor of Reason, thank you also for talking to us on April 17th.
Thanks for having us.
For Reason, this is Nick Gillespie. Thank you so much for listening. And remember to subscribe to us at iTunes. And while you're there, rate and review us and let us know how we're doing. Thanks again for listening.